Hello and welcome to PomoCon, the Postmodern Conservative Podcast. I am your host, Titus, and today I am joined by an eminent professor of political philosophy, William Allen, to talk about his new critical edition, a translation of Montesquieu's Spirit of the Laws. This is one of the great books in the liberal tradition and one of the most unusual, being both incredibly complicated and incredibly attuned to details and to facts of political, social, moral organization, as opposed to theory. And it is, of course, also a work that had a great influence on James Madison, on the Federalist Papers, on the founders of America, and therefore has a living interest politically, not just philosophically. Professor Allen, first of all, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast. It's a treat to talk to somebody on whose expertise one can count and on whose experience one can somehow call. First, please introduce yourself to our audience since you're new to the podcast.
Well, I thank you so very much, Titus, for inviting me to chat with you. I've been looking forward to this. I am, as you properly introduced me, an academic of long standing. I've spent over 50 years in the enterprise. And indeed, I've spent over 50 years on Montesquieu and producing this translation. It's not that I only did this over the course of 50 years. Of course, I published many books in between while still working on this. And the fact of the matter is that this book is delayed because at the time I was most involved in it, so many decades ago, I discovered a dear friend and colleague who was also doing it and whose work was near a publication. And that's the late Ann Kohler. And when her book was ready, I put mine on the shelf for a time so that we had time to appreciate hers and see what legs it might have, as we say in the trade. Ultimately, I decided I would publish my own translation because I thought there were certain things to be accomplished that hadn't been accomplished. This is only the third published translation. And my goal in publishing it was to be as literal as possible without becoming unreadable. That was so critical because it's so important for the grace of Montesquieu to shine through so that people can see that you won't find the customary intellectual hesitations and circumspections. You caught that when you described the details and not theory. He's patient and deliberate, and yet the theoretical underpinnings, the theoretical structure are totally sound. He's perfectly aware of the classical tradition, perfectly aware of the modern tradition. And as I say at the outset of the translation in the foreword, the most interesting and intriguing thing about Montesquieu's Spirit of the Laws is his silence about John Locke. And that silence about John Locke tells us a great deal about what the intention of this work is and how it figures in the modern tradition. Because we know he was not silent about Spinoza, he was not silent about Hobbes, he was not silent about Machiavelli. His silence about Locke, therefore, is a kind of reorganization of the way we think about these things and placing Locke in a perspective as subordinate to Hobbes, or as Leo Strauss originally said, Hobbes warmed over, or something to that effect. So that means that Montesquieu had an understanding not very far away from that Leo Strauss had when it came to reading the modern tradition. And he went beyond in the sense that he always situated the modern tradition in the context of the ancient teachings. He said in his pensée that if you want to understand my work, you have to understand it in light of Plato and Aristotle. And so I take that very seriously, which means that that's, of course, also a reflection of what my career has been. And my teaching has been a teaching in which we've dealt with this very difficult, teasing question for philosophers of where to begin the study of philosophy. And we always remind ourselves that Socrates seemed to begin it with the question, what is the good? But actually, that question has a context, which means the real beginning is not the question. The real beginning is the imposition of politics. Politics is what raises the question of what is the good. So therefore, philosophy begins with politics. And so I have spent a career trying to demonstrate that it is not the reverse, that we begin with philosophy and discover politics. We begin with politics and discover philosophy. And I see Montesquieu as being squarely placed in that tradition. And as you will see from reading the translation and the commentary, that what Montesquieu does is elicit politics, both from the context of human social development and the quest for power, and also from reflection upon the pathways of the philosophical conversation. His is a part of the conversation that carries on from the beginning of philosophy and presumably will carry on to the end of philosophy. So that in my teaching, which has taken place in the United States from California to Michigan and elsewhere, has been always shadowed, as it were, by my experiences as a student of Harry Joppa, Leo Strauss, and Martin Tyman. And in fact, what summarizes this more than anything else is probably the essay I published a little more than a year ago in the journal American Political Thought, which is entitled What Harry Joppa Taught. And so what I've done in that essay is to try to show how my work is situated within the larger tradition of the work of Harry Joppa and Leo Strauss, and those with whom we have all studied and worked over the past several decades. So that I have taught a large number of students, undergraduate and graduate. Many of my students have become professors. We remain in constant communication, and we read very widely. But there's only one thing that is the center of it all, and that is the philosophical enterprise.
Yes, I think that's a beautiful statement of not just our interest in the philosophers, but our general activity, which is something like a commentary. That would be our typical genre. And that has something to do with our awareness that wisdom is there to be acquired, but it is very difficult of acquisition. And it involves many uncertainties and a great need for a clarification that does not do violence to what it is that we study. That's, of course, somehow what sets apart academia in the proper sense from ordinary concerns, where urgency always counts more than giving something another look, giving something another thought, taking another pass or another perspective on an important passage, which has not been properly digested, so to speak. So Montesquieu seems to be both inviting this attention and is almost immune to it. He invites it because he tells so many stories. He points to so many different kinds of events and activities in a context that is of his own design, as he says, and therefore it must be intelligible. But on the other hand, most of these discussions are brief, and he has a great reserve. The design,
yes,
is there, but it is also concealed. So Montesquieu is himself both a philosopher and a commentator. And these seem to come somehow together in his beautiful art of writing, much more gentlemanly than most of the philosophers, especially the modern philosophers, in that he allows a great latitude to men of politics and always treats them with deference, and seems to be indeed a man of experience and of politics himself, which indeed he was.
Yes.
And nevertheless, he has the philosophical intent that we somehow espy in the structure he gives his work and the motion through the work of a guiding thought. This is, I think, what makes us not just persist in study, but in a way jubilate in discoveries that seem to promise there is a kind of completeness, there is a kind of coherence of the whole that has this strange character. Montesquieu seems to promise to everyone that they can have their laws and like them and live well under them. And on the other hand, could not promise this to everybody, universal love of one's own, unless there were something beyond love of one's own, that is love of the good, that offers a standard by which you could judge that these laws actually do make sense for the various circumstances. So there must be something deeper than his moral seriousness and his good manners, something of a philosophical character that, as you suggested, also encourages him or even requires of him to fight off the love of abstraction identified primarily with John Locke, but which he in a way suggests is the problem of thinkers, of philosophers more broadly, that they are incredibly single-minded and incredibly domineering of mankind once they get a single thought in their heads.
You described this very well in your summary, and some of the landmarks we can point to that underscore what it is you now are describing for us are found throughout the text, beginning from the very beginning when he tells us there is a design and you won't know what the book means until you discover it, which is a lovely philosophical way of teasing us into taking what looks like disorder and forcing ourselves to understand why it is not disorder. And then there are, throughout the course of the work, the reminders, as at the end of Book 11, when he says, my purpose is not to make you read, but to make you think. And so throughout the book, we keep running into that. In fact, we run into it at the latter portion of the book when we discover his appreciation of the Crito joke, as I call it. The Crito joke being, of course, the most beautiful joke that we have, given the nature of that dialogue between Socrates and the laws, which follows after Socrates' declaration that we only follow the opinions of the wise. So his throughout the book, he shows these dispositions and transpositions in such a way as to force us to think through. And this descends even into the level of detail. I'll give you one example of that detail, which is also an example of the grace of his writing that I was trying to emphasize. At the end of book seven, chapter 17, he has a book which in French is De l'administration des femmes, which is typically translated on the administration of women. But that misses, it's both are ambiguous, but the ambiguity in French is not the same as the ambiguity in English, and it misses his point. So I've translated it, as you know, on the management of women, which allows us to see exactly what it is he's talking about. And he conveys there both the fact that women need to be managed socially, and women may manage politically. Now, when we say that, we're forced to recognize something, that the social and the political are not one sphere. This is the crux of his entire teaching. They are separate spheres, and they respond to separate criteria. And the one, the social, is prior to the political. And therefore, we have to find how the political comes to be out of a social foundation, which takes us back to Aristotle, of course, and Aristotelian anthropology. So we see in Montesquieu, if you go back to Book 11, Chapter 6, where he makes this beautiful statement, which when, if you treat it exegetically, unfolds a world of meaning. And the statement is this, that every man thought to have a free soul ought to be self-governing. Now, two, three centuries, we have read that without paying attention to what it means. It is a restatement of Aristotle's argument about natural slavery. It is what is at the bottom of the argument about natural slavery, and which leads Montesquieu in the center of his book to reject slavery altogether and realize that that's the point of Aristotle's teaching. But the most important part of it is, it's a statement about what the concept of virtue actually means. For in Aristotle, that virtue is best understood as self-government. Yes, of course, it's pointed toward the good, the excellent, but the foundation of that is self-government. So free souls, self-government, virtue, these things are all there embedded in the teaching which Montesquieu unfolds. But he tells us, and this goes back to your original statement, Titus, he tells us, we can't get to it unless we tease it out of the fundamental anthropology, the fundamental social conditions, and realize that society is natural, not artificial. That the politics later, that's constructed. And that gives us certain powers because we can construct it deliberately once we become mindful of it. But the society founded on the family is perfectly natural, and the society grows out of that family structure, and everything must be built, therefore, in relation to it. All of this comes out of seeing the component parts, including his review of potential determinism. And that's what the arguments about nature and climate are about, or the influence of the terrain. So as you work your way through the book, you work your way towards a summit. And the summit, which I've called libertarian individualism, as you know, is best expressed in seeing what his mature and sensitive understanding of commerce is about. We've tended to reduce that to the cash nexus, finances, trade. He knows that. He gives us a definition of money that's as modern as you're going to get. He talks about these things in ways that anticipate Adam Smith and in some ways go beyond Adam Smith, but he does what nobody else does. The word commerce in French, of course, we can translate intercourse. And that, in a way, captures far more what it was Montesquieu sought to convey, because he's talking about human intercourse, not just in financial transactions, but ultimately in response to the Herodotean problematic of religion, commerce in ideas, commerce in religious beliefs. He's created a whole constellation out of what typically remain only component parts in philosophical reflection.
Yeah, there is something in Montesquieu that is incredibly ambitious in this regard. He makes it more clear than many other modern philosophers that there is a distinction between our articulations and the beings we try to articulate, between
Yes.
our speeches or treatises and the things that they are about, and that what they are about is a deeper thing, that society is a deeper thing than politics from a certain point of view, that from a certain point of view, female is deeper than male. It's the management of women with the ambiguity of the genitive use there. That is offered as a provocation somehow, and as a promise. Promise, as you said, we somehow all grasp. It's modern private life. What a wonderful thing. But there is also a provocation in it because it implies, as you suggested, as you said, that commerce goes far beyond goods and services.
Yes.
Commerce is a way of acquisition. There are other ways of acquisition, obviously war, and all of them have to face some kind of metaphysical problem. How does nature turn into property? And how does, you know, we talk about real estate. What makes it real? There is therefore a question for man. How can he be human in relation to the things he needs, which are not themselves human? The human being stands on the ground of being that is unlike human being. There is therefore a need for a kind of provocation and for a kind of daring, such as Montesquieu possesses, to try to connect our understanding or hope in our freedom, and seems to be primarily the concern of the first half of the book, with the proper understanding of freedom, or freedom ordered to some kind of reasonable grasp of our context or our nature, which is more the second half of the book. That's to some extent guesswork on my part. So please, Professor, tell us about the structure of the book, the kinds of regimes he considers, and the way he transitions from ancient and modern freedom to these concerns of climate, terrain, and the limits on human nature.
Yes, you certainly raised the proper question, because he tells us at the outset, man is subject to differing orders of law. And I like the term orders there, because his distinction between the natural, the religious, the philosophical, and of course the political, or the laws that man gives himself, represent orders of law. But the orders of law all are pointed towards what we might call the exigencies of nature. And so reconciling those, or coordinating the orders of law, becomes the great task. And he is quite clear to show us in two differing expressions that it is the human propensity to error that causes us to wander in the field of ambiguities that you have described. So that while we reason, we cannot depend on our reason's infallibility, because it's fallible. And that's why he's led in Book 19, Chapter 27, to say of the modern liberal regime, everybody is reasoning there, but it doesn't matter. What matters is that they reason, not the conclusions that they reach. Now, that sounds almost as if it were teasingly ironic, but it's actually very serious, because that reasoning takes us back to the very beginnings that you're talking about, that the human condition is trying to sort itself with recourse to reason in contexts in which it is subject to contingencies. And so, as I point out in the commentary, he walks us through the various contingencies, the material, the moral, social, the political, to demonstrate that each case there is posed a problem to be resolved with recourse to reasoning. And I emphasize reasoning, not reason, because he doesn't expect infallibility in our reason. But we have no way to approach either the questions of property acquisition or other forms of cultivation independently of reasoning. Now, it is this reasoning then that must be driven by something, by the fundamental human things, the things that we can't get complete command of. And these are what he demonstrates when he demonstrates that in the first ages of human anthropology, there is a clear recognition of what we might call the potentiality of human socialization, human association. That you bring a group together and you suddenly discover there's a force multiplier in the group. And that means if you can command that, you have extended your reach, you've projected your power beyond your person. And that leads to the quest for power, which is why the primary, most primitive forms are despotic. And there is this battle for power. Then he demonstrates for us, and this goes to your question of the forms of regime, that something has to come into place to try to limit that power if we're going to retain the openness of the beginnings, where each is trying to conduct him or herself through reasoning, because there's incompatibility between being subject to the power of another and directing oneself by one's reason. And so the response to that quest for power becomes politics. The whole purpose of politics is to limit power. That's Montesquieu's account. And that's why we end up talking about constitutionalism. We're not designing institutions to acquire power. In the 20th century, political science defined politics as power, completely misunderstanding what the origins were. And Montesquieu had already given us an asociological account, which shows that politics is really how we go about trying to restore fundamental liberties and preserve fundamental liberties by limiting the stretch of power. And you can do that, according to Montesquieu's account, if you structure institutions in such a way that this mad quest for power is always kept under, always restrained. It's not going to disappear, because we're talking about inclinations of the human soul, human appetites, human character. But can it be restrained becomes the question. And Montesquieu's argument is it can be deliberately constrained. We can do this through such devices as the separation of authorities. And we have always translated that elsewhere as the separation of powers. But as you know, I've said it's really the separation of authorities, because he uses different words to describe these things, the word power, pouvoir, the word puissance for authority, ultimately. And when he gets to the separation passage, it's separation of puissance, not pouvoir. These subtleties, this gracefulness in Montesquieu are what reveal, once we notice them, the structure of the book and the tendency of the argument. So that by bringing them out, we are finally coming face to face with the rather stark reality when you stop to think about it. If we find ourselves politically at an impasse, it's because we have ceased to think about politics. It's pretty straightforward. We become, in a certain sense, imprisoned by a few orthodoxies, which happen to be too compatible with power, and too underappreciative of politics properly understood. That's why he makes a distinction between political liberty, the liberty framed by the Constitution, and the liberty of the citizen. Because he wants us to see the liberty of the citizen must be the guidepost. The political liberty will organize the structure within which we preserve the liberty of the citizen. And he drives this through to the smallest details. But nothing reveals, it seems to me, with such great clarity, the purpose of this constitutionalism, all these structures, than the central books, 15, 16, and 17 of the Spirit of the Laws. Because those are the books in which he squarely confronts the question of slavery and clearly rejects slavery, including race-based slavery. For the first time, really, this is done, and done it with philosophical consistency. So that we see that there's a connection between the defense of liberty and the rejection of slavery, all of which point back to that fundamental passage in Book 11, Chapter 6 that I mentioned, that every man thought to have a free soul ought to be self-governing. So we now know what the lodestar is. People say Montesquieu is non-teleological, a-teleological. Well, I'm willing to accept that in a limited way, so long as we understand that there's still a lodestar. There's a fundamental condition to which everything else must lead in order for human life to prosper. And so that is a life in which it is possible to secure libertarian individualism by preserving the priority of social relations.
Yeah, part of this shows in Montesquieu's willingness or even insistence on showing that the modern regime of liberty has specific dangers to which it is exposed, precisely because political liberty and the liberty of the citizen are in fact different kinds of things. And it is very easy under pretense of political liberty to impose despotism on the citizen. It's somewhat like the distinction that we now all feel between a kind of national greatness and an individual, not just irrelevance or interchangeability, but being endangered. Always some kind of invisible power can reach into your life and suddenly you are criminal or somehow suspect. And that's the specific danger to which we are open once we separate politics from society, as modern politics requires that we do. And so that danger is the correlative to this great promise that we see in the separation of authorities of the development of different types of human intelligence. Whoever has met an intelligent senator and an intelligent justice knows that there are different kinds of intelligences. They don't just have different careers, but those careers speak to different personalities, we can call them, or characters. Yes. It would be better to say they are all intelligent, they're best learned, but they look at things very, very differently. So the complexity of the Montesquieu system of constitutionalism has a lot to do with protecting something that is natural and social in human diversity, different faculties and different uses of them that all somehow seem to contribute to the human good while retaining their distinctiveness. And that, of course, is at the same time in danger if the liberty of the citizen itself becomes in danger, given this perpetual problem of despotism, the thing that first shows up once you realize, as you're saying, that politics has its own character, that there is something in our capacity to believe things that runs far ahead of our capacity to know, investigate, think through thoroughly, and make use of with caution, if not with prudence. And that shows up, of course, even in our modern situation. So perhaps, Professor, we can look at this question of, we are grateful and remember Montesquieu primarily for the separation of authorities and his contribution to modern liberal constitutionalism. Can we talk about how he understands and presents the potentialities and the dangers of such an arrangement?
Well, remember the discussion in the commentary that's really an elaboration of what he means in his general theory, particularly by the time he gets to the discussion of terrain and the Herodotean problem, is that all tragedy is local, which is to say, it is precisely the impulse towards universalization that conveys the great danger you're describing. The tyranny of expertise defeats the impulses of human reasoning, and therefore, his argument is to show that what politics really means in its constitutional sense is resistance to universalism. That's why he's anti-utopian, you see. It is not that he denies that there's this mythical, unexpected way in the future, perfect life can possibly exist. He's not saying anything about that at all. What he's saying is that the only human life is that life which unfolds within natural human communities, and politics must sustain that. And so trying to literally make immanent, so, and therefore immediately present to our minds, some kind of universal accomplishment is itself the enemy of liberty, the enemy of politics. Politics is meant precisely to resist that degree of universalization, which you will observe represents a kind of tension with the ambition of philosophy. Now, I don't mean to say that philosophy aims to be political in the sense of producing a universal regime, but philosophy, of course, as you properly pointed out, aspires to one understanding. And one understanding leads some to think in terms of universal impositions. So clearly, it's in tension with that. And Montesquieu's philosophical posture, this is really what he means when he says, we cure ourselves daily of Machiavellianism. that there is no way to reconcile science or expertise that will leave expertise in complete control of human life with the demands of human life itself. It's not possible to do that. That's what we cure ourselves of daily, that false affectation. So all tragedy is local because the expression of human hopes must take place in human context, and that means naturally, socially. We aren't, as it were, elevating the primitive. That's not what, he's not Rousseau. You see, there's none of that specter of innocence in all of this. Montesquieu knows the full range of human weaknesses and fallibilities, but he is insisting throughout the work that we have to take the contingencies seriously, and the contingencies must be met, as it were, on their own terms, that you must make your decision based with each contingency as it emerges, that there is not one single solution that forestalls contingency.
Yeah, so one extreme statement of the position of Montesquieu we find in Tocqueville, who goes so far as to say that in the mind of God, there are nothing but particulars. There is perfect mm-hmm. knowledge of each contingency. Yes. That the phenomena, as we sometimes say in philosophy, are saved. But of course, that is not possible for human beings. We must always generalize, and we are, in fact, always creating general theories of generalization. We want to systematize our over-eagerness, our rushing to conclusions. We perhaps all catch ourselves now and then, or perhaps our attention is attracted to the tendency to say to somebody, even after only a few meetings or a short conversation, well, you're always like that. You always say this sort of thing.
Well, you just described what Harry Jaffa meant by the miracle of the common noun. Yes, I go beyond saying we always generalize, or often do, and say we only generalize. We always, yes, you may identify your particular Fido, but not until after you've said dog. We only generalize, and we approach the particulars through generalizations. And of course, that's what introduces the degree of fallibility to which we're subject. So that's part of our difficulty. We formulate our aspirations, our ambitions on the basis of generalizations, which are ultimately always inapplicable.
Yeah, exactly. There's always this odd relationship between the particular and the general. We could not generalize if we didn't have experience and encounter with particular things. But whenever we encounter particular things, even to recognize them, we somehow have to generalize. And of course, this sets up the problem we find in the laws and points out the fact that somehow the element of surprise, which is another way, is the core issue, which is another way to say what you're saying about tragedy being local. We cannot help but noticing that knowing something is very pleasant. Whenever you recognize something, it's very satisfying. Just like whenever you say, "Oh, I see," it's very satisfying. Whereas learning is often painful and full of uncertainty. And so somehow that's the relationship between our memory of the past and our imaginations of the future. The future, it makes a lot less sense and is a lot more uncertain. And that is painful. And that is somehow the domain of law to deal with that difficulty, since, of course, some of the surprises could be catastrophic. And
Yes.
So the law seems to originate in this protective power of generalization, while somehow concealing the limits, the limited knowledge involved in any such attitude to the future. And
Yeah.
and so Montesquieu must somehow reveal this while still preserving the character of the law as law, which, among other things, has to be authoritative. It can't be just, you generalize. It has to somehow be authoritative for us. And as he shows, it has effects on us. In knowing that these are our laws, we somehow become the kinds of people whose laws these laws are.
That is very well put, but it also I want to remind you, returns us to Plato's Phaedrus, in which we discover the absolutely critical dimension in which the laws, while only being one, of course, in any particular case, must nevertheless speak to different understandings. And so the same law must say different things to different people. Now that's the magic, the trick of reconciling law to the local contingencies. And overcoming, therefore, our inclination to set our sights in terms of our own experience rather than the general demand upon us that the law makes. So we're always caught in that kind of tension as mere practical beings subject to the force of law. But we are not only being subject to the force of, let us say, positive law, because that's what we're talking about. But we have all the other laws that he described in the first book of the Spirit of the Laws. And in those, he made very clear that, look, they are going to militate sometimes against one another. And that's the way they work. They're not always going to be of the same character or pronounced the same, whether it's the law of nature, the law of religion, the law of philosophy, the law of politics. So the fact that we must navigate those laws, those orders of law, means that we have the capacity to navigate the positive laws, that we can escape the prison of overgeneralization, because we are forced to do so, that our capacity for reasoning itself, though we aren't going to be error-free, that capacity to reason forces us to escape the prison of overgeneralization. Now, Montesquieu said at the very outset in his preface to his work, "Et moi aussi je suis peintre," I too am a painter. And you will see that one of the things I have observed, again, for centuries we've read that and we've thought it's wonderful poetry and we haven't bothered to ask what it means, right? But I said, well, what on earth does that mean? He never painted anything in his life. So why does he say that with Correggio, I also am a painter? Well, he was not invoking the art of painting. He was invoking the character of Correggio's art, which is a character which is assimilable to the character of Marat's poetry and art, which is to say, distinguishing between the sacred and profane, the poetic and the prosaic, and remembering how important it is to render things prosaically so that you can speak into the particular contingencies and to therefore not inflate rhetorically or otherwise, the representations that we make. Well, is this de-inflation of our representations that lies at the heart of overcoming overgeneralization in the law?
Yeah, I think I understand that. It's something that strikes me now and then. I interpret the remark about Correggio based on the fact that Correggio is not the greatest painter there ever was. But and so there's a kind of modesty in claiming that he is nevertheless a painter, but also a certain kind of pride. He does belong somehow in the same class as the greats. And with respect to the connection you made, it strikes me now and then this unusual beauty of the writing of Montesquieu, that he finds it very funny that somehow ambiguity is the solution to our trouble with the law, given that the law itself is some kind of solution to the problem of unpredictability. It is precisely that, although it is supposed to be authoritative and therefore one, it is nevertheless somehow ambiguous that makes it possible for us to be free. I find him charming and persuasive in this regard. He has a graceful way of showing how some of our limits can help us deal with the problems other of our limits set to us. That is some way of showing that there is a kind of providence or good within human nature, not in escaping from, but precisely in dwelling on our situation and predicament.
Well, you there capture what I think he means when he says to us, it is infinitely easier to do good than to do well. And that's really an important expression that one should always recall, because the world is filled with do-gooders. But those who are truly excellent and who can do well, they are going to be rare.
That's I think a sobering thought, but again, in a way, it's also very reassuring. There are excellent men among us, and yes, surely one of them. Let me approach then this subject also. Tell us something about your thoughts on the relationship between the ancient liberty and the modern liberty, between the Greeks and the Rome on the one side and Britain and France on the other side.
Well, it's interesting that you ask that question, because there's also embedded in the spirit of the laws, of course, what you might call the continuation or conclusion of the work on the greatness and decline of the Romans. Not attention has been paid to that, but there are long discussions about the Romans, so that as if he hadn't finished the first book and he's continuing it in the course of the spirit of the laws. And what's the question of Rome? The question is, where did Rome fail? Or let me put it a little differently. Skipping over some of the important details and those that are conveyed through the life of Sulla and others that he's written about. But the really single most important fact about Rome is that Rome fell and Christianity survived. That is the dominant fact of history. Barbarians invaded Rome and became Christians. Now, I don't know if people quite understand the significance of that, but Montesquieu did, because it meant that there was this force of religious conviction, religious belief, that had the power to endure beyond all the constraints of power and politics, and that showed the fundamental resilience of human sociality. This demonstration meant more than anything. So how do we relate ancient theories to modern theories? It is in this discovery that Christianity survived and was propagated throughout the earth in the presence of massive political failure. That means more than anything. That means liberty survived, first and foremost. You can't underscore. Liberty survived without political protection. I'll put it that way. You see. And so that means that the concepts of liberty in the ancient and the modern world must be taken in terms of the characters and capacities of individuals, and not in terms of the promises of laws. That's the fundamental conclusion to be drawn. So is his liberty like that of the ancients? Well, in one way, yes, and another way, no. The liberties were of the ancients, of course, were focused on the citizens, the pambazaleia, in the Aristotelian context, the emergence of the human model of surpassing excellence, as I've described it in my work on Harriet Beecher Stowe, in fact, because that's what Uncle Tom is about. And if we read Uncle Tom's Cabin in light of this discussion, we would come to a far deeper understanding of what the distinction is between ancient and modern liberty. So the human model of surpassing excellence is a true model, but it is not a universalizable model and was never intended to be. Whereas modern liberty is intended to be the property of all, not because it's universalizable positively, but because it's universal intrinsically. Every man thought to have a free soul ought to be self-governing. So he's saying the natural foundations are what describe modern liberty, as opposed to the accomplishments that describe ancient liberty.
And this must somehow tie into our remark about commerce and the way in which, in a sense, it seems very superficial, but people don't live and die for commerce. And in another way, it goes deeper than our ordinary understanding of politics, legislation, and so on, obviously, because it crosses boundaries, but because it changes manners and mores. It's not exactly that people live and die for commerce, it's that in commerce, they find things that they live for, that commerce has this depth that makes it comparable to religion. Indeed, you applied the thought that commerce includes also the change of ideas and beliefs.
I like that formulation very much, that in commerce they find something to live for. So it becomes not merely the question of material prosperity. It really does become the question of situating oneself with respect to the contingencies of life in a favorable position. That's what it's all about. So yes, and I think that was Montesquieu's appreciation as well. That's why he could remember the other side. He could remember the obligations of charity, but say it's not enough to give alms to a beggar. So this fundamental dimension of humanity is fully present there. He could remember the importance of protesting things like the Inquisition or religious persecution. He could include in his Book 12 the observation there's no such thing as a thought crime. The details, I just go on and on, and I could recite them endlessly to show his sensitive appreciation for the distinction we're now talking about. All of them come back to reinforcing the integrity of the individual.
And Montesquieu himself is a great example of the uses of commerce at all levels, not just because he made himself tremendously successful, but because of his influence over thought in the 18th century and beyond, precisely in defense of this kind of freedom, the freedom of the citizen in terms of Book 12 and the possibility of overcoming one's prejudices, the all-too-human inclination to generalize that nevertheless bears the stamp of the circumstances in which it originates. As he remarks, after all, the prejudices of judges were once the prejudice of the nation. That's where they learn it. And so that locality bears a great burden. It has to keep us together, but it could keep us together against our human capacity for flourishing. It has to somehow retain togetherness while mitigating the difficulties that come from the pressure of events, the pressure of necessity, and including our limited grasp. And so it's somehow to be ourselves, we need to understand also what it means to be human. Hence this notion of the libertarian individualism, as you put it, Montesquieu is guide to human flourishing.
Very much so. And he recognizes, of course, the conditions under which that flourishing becomes possible. His concluding books on the origins of feudal society and their development into more modern forms is highly instructive in this regard. And you will remember he starts out by talking about forms of punishment and the challenge and such things. But at one point he makes the observation that when they used to have trial by fire or branding iron or one thing or the other, that seems to our more tender ears somehow brutal and insensitive. He said, but it was at least the case that if they had lived in accord with the mores of the time, they might indeed have been able to survive that. they could survive those challenges simply because they had been hardened to the necessities of life in those conditions. So there's that element of it in which we are not reflections so much of the environment, to speak loosely, in which we're raised, but that we do internalize the requirements of the contingencies in which we're raised and adapt, therefore, to them. It doesn't make them ideal, it doesn't make them rational, but it does make it possible for human beings to survive them.
And it somehow leaves room for the possibility of improving them.
Yes, and they do improve. That's what those final books demonstrate. And so that his concluding words, Italium, Italium, I've discovered the new Rome, and basically is what that means. And it is a Rome that is beyond mere nationhood. And that's really critical. Remember, he told us very early in The Spirit of the Laws in the third book already that England was really a republic in the disguise of a monarchy. And that seemed rather an elliptical statement at the time he made it. Then he gives us, of course, that Book 11 in which he gives us the model of England. And so he's showing us what those republican elements are. But then he concludes that by saying, I'm not saying they actually lived this way, but that's what they could do given the Constitution. And then he gives us Book 19, in which he shows their life in their politics. And it becomes very clear just what that republicanism under the disguise of monarchy is really all about. And that's not incompatible with what we know about the history of England. One of the things that I've discovered since completing this translation, Titus, that is truly remarkable and probably more significant than anything else that will come out of this whole project, is that George III read Montesquieu very carefully. In fact, translated / paraphrased almost the whole of The Spirit of the Laws, as well as writing several essays on the relevant topics, related topics himself. And he fully embraced the theory that he found there, which gives us an entirely new picture on what transpired at the revolution. Because it turned out that George, from what I can see, and I'm still looking at this now, so I won't give you a final conclusion, but it appears that what George was doing was trying to remove the disguise in England and to reform that constitution so as to project fully the aspirations revealed in Montesquieu's work. And it is not an accident that George was the last crown sovereign in England. After that, the monarch became a symbol, not an executive. So we can see, we could talk about the American Revolution and his influence, but we can see right there the extraordinary power of the argument that Montesquieu was making and the influence it had on this young Prince of Wales who became the King of England.
That is indeed remarkable. I did not know that. And so Montesquieu is very well represented on both sides of that conflict.
Yes, yes, indeed.
There's philosophic in that. Sir, I think this is a wonderful note to end on, not least because it advertises further work and further discoveries on your part, perhaps for a future conversation.
Yes.
Thank you very much for your time. This has been very pleasant and instructive since, as I said, I am working through your critical edition, partly for the purpose of reviewing it. This is helpful for some of my thoughts as I go along, and some guidance for some of the things that interest you and that orient your own thinking as an interpreter of Montesquieu. So I am very grateful for that, and I hope our audience will also take to this. The volume is amazing because it has the French and the English side by side. It will help many people look for themselves, and it will help people who have a grasp of French but not great French to read both of them. And I think there's probably also some help in thinking about the differences between the French and the English, and the difference between their kinds of writers. One sees more clearly with the help of your edition that the French writers have a different manner than the English ones. And yes, there is a lot to notice in there about modern politics and about the turn of the mind. I think that is something Montesquieu himself would approve. So this is a wonderful surprise, this volume of yours. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome, and I thank you. It's been a wonderful and gracious morning with you.
All the best until next time, sir.
All righty. God bless you.
Thank you. Likewise.